This is talking with George Field on 10 January 1979 at the AAS meeting in Mexico City. Now, can you tell me when you first came into contact with radio astronomy?
Yes, I was sitting at my desk as a graduate student in Princeton and was reading an article about 21 centimeter emission, which had just been discovered by the Dutch, of course. And it occurred to me, on the basis of work that was going on at the observatory at that time, that 21 centimeter absorption should be observable also.
Mm-hmm.
And I contacted the Naval Research Laboratory, which at that time had one of the big dishes in this country, and proposed such an experiment. Well, in fact, I never got a response to that. However, I read some time later that Lilly, McLean, and Hagen, had detected it. And Ed Lilly has the rest of that story because he was there.
Yes, right. I know about that story, but I didn't realize that you tried to get them interested in terms of writing them a letter? Or?
Yes, I had written a letter, and I think the letter which they published in APJ gives me credit for having had conversations with them, which is not correct. What I'd done is written a letter to them explaining that this effect should exist but and how to look for it.
But you never did publish anything on it or give a talk or anything like that?
Not that particular discovery.
Right.
No.
Now, this, of course, was a theme throughout the 50s in your work, was the 21-centimeter line, the whole excitation mechanism and so forth.
Sure.
Did you work on this anymore at Princeton, or was it only when you...
Yes, I continue to be interested in the subject, and I remember a discussion at the AAS meeting in Princeton in the spring of 1955. I was just finishing my thesis at that time on plasma oscillations as applied to the solar atmosphere. And this meeting was interesting because of a number of different events. First of all, it was the one where the discovery of the radio emission from Jupiter was announced.
Oh, yes.
Franklin
and
Bergen.
And
Dave Heeshan was at that meeting. At that time, he was either a student or a postdoc at Harvard. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe a student in 55.
About this line somewhere.
Yeah. And the thought had occurred to me that intergalactic matter could be a major component of the universe. I had read some papers that indicated that might be true, and I talked to him about the possibility of observing the 21-centimeter line in absorption. And he very kindly suggested that I come up to Harvard and look at their radio astronomy observatory, which at that time I think had a 28-footer or something.
That's
like
right.
That.
That's right.
And he was very encouraging that maybe I would be able to do something like that. Well, as it turned out, I won a fellowship to Harvard. And one of the things that I was immediately attracted by was the vitality of the 21-centimeter group under Bach, which, as you know, contained many of the people who later went on to do a lot of work in radio astronomy. And that then led to a kind of two-pronged approach on this intergalactic medium problem. First, to understand the physics of the problem, I undertook a theoretical study with Ed Purcell, who was a professor of physics there. And then I undertook these observations at Agassiz. And that went smoothly, except for the time that the nautical almanac, which was leaning on the limit switch, to allow me to go very far over in my observations of Cygnus A. I forgot that it was leaning on that.
It was purposely there?
It was purposely there. It was standard practice at that time. And I drove the antenna into the pedestal at that time. Now, by that time, it was a 60-footer. I believe it had been upgraded by the time that I got there.
The paper here, was 60-foot. You published an APJ in 59.
Right. But it was a lot of fun. Not too much damage was done. And I did get some results, which were published, and they provided a constraint. And since that time, that ground has been gone over many times. I came back to it myself in 1957, I believe it was. I'd been at Harvard as a postdoc for 2 years, and then I was offered an assistant professorship at Princeton, went back there, continued this interest, and made plans to use the larger telescope, which is, of course, important. For this kind of
observation. More signal noise. You're doing absorption measurement, right.
Of course, beyond a certain point, it really doesn't help any because it's a percentage effect that you're looking for. And once you get the temperature, your source temperature up above your noise temperature in your system, it doesn't help anymore.
Right.
But in those days, we were still reaching for that.
Right.
Yeah. And as I remember, it was the spring of 58, if that's possible.
Well, I can double check that.
Yeah. It was probably in the logbooks and so on, but I remember things were very primitive. And
well, that's precisely, I think, when Frank Drake did his Ozma. Was it that same season? Do you remember?
Well, I know that Frank was observing Venus at the time. Not, was it Venus or Jupiter? It was Jupiter. And I remember being in the control room when Frank asked me to come over and look at the chart recorder. It was giving a temperature for Jupiter, which was several times greater than it had been predicted on the basis of the
thermal
disk.
This was a microwave, 10 centimeters.
It would have been, 3 centimeters?
Maybe, I think that's right. Yeah,
it was fairly high frequency.
Right.
And that's how I get interested in the Jupiter problem.
Oh, I see. It wasn't from back in Burke and Franklin's announcement that you mentioned earlier.
Well, I suppose that, too. I had that in the back of my mind, but the specific thing, of course, the very exciting discovery of the what was then called the decimeter radiation,
right.
Which then makes me think maybe it was, the situation.
I think you're right. I think it is 3 centimeters.
The first thing was 3 centimeters, yeah. And then other people rapidly followed it up at 10 centimeters,
right.
And then
yeah,
the effect was much bigger, of course, because the thermal radiation would be falling off at that point. And so I got into that and published in that area. But getting back to the conditions at Greenbank, there are a lot of people there then who then went on to become good radio astronomers. Gart Westerhout was there using the dish. Dave Heeshan, of course, Frank Drake, Coach Menon, as I recall.
But you were a visitor in the present sense. Did you just submit a proposal like one does today?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think that it was done on the basis of private conversations. Greenbank was just starting up. Conditions were very primitive. I seem to remember slogging around in the mud a good bit. And it had not yet revved up to the point that one needed to have a formal procedure. That's the way I remember
it. Right. But it was still such that a user who was not particularly electronically oriented could go in and use the telescope, I gather.
That's true. Of course, I had the advantage that Dave and Frank particularly, I remember, helped me with electronics. And there was some particularly tricky business about getting rid of the image frequency, it being a superhead system.
Mm-hmm.
It was important, the way I was doing the experiment, to just have a single channel and not both channels, the image frequency as well. And so there was a system to do that. And also, I had to retune the whole system every time I made an observation, because I was covering what for that time was a fairly wide frequency band,
right.
Like 5% or something like that.
Yeah.
And they were very helpful in getting that.
But of course, you had experience at Agassiz also.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I'd be interested in your opinion as sort of a semi-outsider at Agassiz. I've talked to several of the people that were more closely associated with it. They had a number of spurious results. And on the other hand, it was also a place where the receiver was built primarily by Doc Ewan, and the users came in and used it.
Yep.
And I get the impression, do you think this is all right, that they didn't really understand quite how far to trust the baselines and so forth, and therefore they optimistically interpreted their things. Do you think that's a fair assessment, or?
I think there were some very competent people there. Both Dave and Frank had experience in the service and knew what they were doing in this area. What you say is right, that the equipment was largely built by Doc Ewan. It wasn't kind of a physics operation where the equipment was built by the individual, so he knew all the ins and outs. I also think that Bart Bock was a very enthusiastic leader, and he deserves a tremendous amount of credit for getting that all going. He was not particularly familiar with the workings of the apparatus, mm-hmm. or indeed the ins and outs of interpreting data of this kind. And so maybe he wasn't as critical.
The final review of the leader of the group, more or less.
That may have been a problem mm-hmm. there. I suspect
yeah.
it was. Actually, it was a situation there at Harvard where it was odd in a way that Ed Purcell didn't take more of a hand in it, because Ed, after all, had been involved in the discovery of the thing. It was his student who then went off and formed the company that built the receivers. It would have been natural for him to get involved very directly, you know, but he never did.
Well, I've talked to him, and he simply says he just wanted to go on in physics, you know.
Yeah.
He just didn't want to follow it up. It always seemed strange to me, too, that
that's right.
Where the Dutch really ran with the ball, and Harvard, it wasn't until Bach came along a few years later that really got going there.
That's right. And now, of course, Ed spends a lot of his time in astronomy. He has become very fascinated with the problem of interstellar grains and polarization.
Right.
He spends a lot of time on that.
Well, the intergalactic medium we've talked about. What about the Purcell and Field paper 56, which is, can you tell me, was that pretty straightforward from your point of view, how that had to be worked out, or were there particular difficulties that you felt that weren't being appreciated by the workers in the field?
No, I think it was straightforward. I have to tell you that the basic ideas were Ed's, but I did the work and I refined the ideas. Then I published a later paper that I think was referred to often by people in the field on the question of spin temperature. It was kind of synthesis of all the people had done up to that time. It was the one that was in the proceedings
of the IRE.
IRE
in that special
58.
Issue. Yeah. Right.
It was an odd place for it to appear, as it turned out, that it wasn't that accessible to people. But there I did add some new things of my own. In particular, I got very involved in the whole question of the coupling of Lyman alpha to this line, and worked out a solution to that. And that led to a problem of radiative transfer, which I was able to solve when I was at Harvard. And it was rather unique for the time. It was a time-dependent.
Right, I have a note on that one.
Yeah.
What was the inspiration of that? Why time-dependent star turning on? What were you thinking of?
No, basically the goal was to solve a spatial-dependent problem of a gas, hydrogen gas, scattering a resonant line photon like Lyman alpha, and seeing whether, in fact, you would get a very flat central maximum, as had been predicted by several people. And I found that I could not solve that problem. I just didn't have the mathematics to do it, and they still don't have the mathematics to do it exactly. But I found, to my delight, that a very closely related problem, namely of injecting a photon, a delta function distribution of photons in a cloud, an infinite cloud, and then watching it relax in time,
I see,
could be solved exactly. And that's referred to sometimes because it's one of the few things in transfer theory that can be solved exactly. And then it's pretty easy to reason how that time-dependent scattering problem then applies to the spatial scattering problem, because the time and space become closely correlated. So that did, I think, have quite an impact, that calculation, the Lyman alpha coupling to 21 centimeters, and then the synthesis in this paper of 58 was referred to a lot as giving the justification for assuming in most cases that the spin temperature
was the kinetic temperature.
Is equal to the kinetic temperature or close to it, yeah.
Let me ask a general question about this era. You were primarily a theorist, but doing observations also in both radio and optical regimes, so to speak, but this is not usual at that time. If you can put yourself back then, did you just see radio as a perfectly legitimate part of astronomy that should be treated like everything else?
Sure.
Or,
sure.
So there was no bias whatsoever in your part?
No, the problems that interested me for some reason often ended up having the closest relationship to radio astronomy, and so I went out and tried to do what I could to observe the things. And I think if it had been the other way, I would have tried to do optical observations as well. I've never regarded radio astronomy as anything but a branch of astronomy.
Well, other people did, especially at that time, in the 50s. Did you see yourself at all as unusual in that respect, or?
You say that they did, but I wonder if that's right. For example, the AAS, as far as I know, never had a separate division of radio astronomy.
No, that's true.
And it's true that the people. There were some people who were very sensitive to that because I think they had come through training, particularly in engineering departments.
Right.
You think of people like Fred Haddock, for example.
Krauss and all the NRL
Ed,
people.
Ed McLean, exactly. And they felt more comfortable with other people who had sort of an engineering background rather than an astronomical background. And so to some extent, yeah, they did feel apart. But since I had been trained in astronomy, I just regarded this as a new technique that we could apply to astronomy. And I think that's the way it was regarded at Harvard, as far as I know. There was no, you know, that was definitely part of the program.
Right.
It was a very exciting part of the program.
But Harvard is somewhat unique. Leiden is another example, where it really was incorporated right into astronomy, as opposed to being in an engineering lab or in an engineering department or a physics department.
That's true.
It's usually the way it was in most laboratories around the world.
That's true, and yet, as we were discussing earlier, the fact that maybe these results were overinterpreted may have been, to some extent, a result of that, that there wasn't the engineering input that there might have been at some of these other places.
Yeah. So as you look back on it, anyway, you don't see yourself as one who bridges the gap between the two sub-disciplines?
I never thought of myself that way, to be honest with you. I always felt that, in a way I suppose it's right, because I certainly had many friends and colleagues in the radio astronomy community. I would go to special sessions on radio astronomy, but I was very much involved in other parts of astronomy too. There weren't that many people who were doing that at that time.
Let's just talk a minute about the Jupiter work, which you alluded to. First of all, you were not concerned with the decametric bursts and so forth.
Right.
It was this microwave enhancement.
Right.
And you had a couple papers in JGR and FJ and so forth on the idea that it was cyclotron radiation from electrons trapped in the Jovian magnetic field. But
that's right.
In the abstracts that I went through, it did mention at one point that this required the 1,200 Gauss field for Jupiter.
Yes, that's right.
So I presume then that I don't know. Did this hold up, and what was the status at that time about our understanding of what was going on?
Well, Frank Drake, I think, said right away that it has to be synchrotron radiation, and that was, after all, shortly after the discovery of the Van Allen belts. Okay, I don't quite know why I went off in the direction of cyclotron radiation. I think I was particularly intrigued by the fact that if you confine yourself to cyclotron radiation, that is non-relativistic electrons, then you can predict the spectrum from the particle pitch angle distribution. The point is that if the particles are all circling at 90 degree pitch angle, they stay in the equatorial plane. There's then a sharp line at a frequency corresponding to the cyclotron frequency at the equatorial magnitude of the magnetic field. But
you mean it's a more tractable problem?
Exactly calculable problem,
right.
And there's a one-to-one correspondence between the spectrum, which was then being measured, and the observed, the pitch angle distribution, which at that time was very interesting. People, in connection with the Van Allen belts, were they trapped near the equator, or did they penetrate into the planet, all this kind of thing. But then, having written that paper in JGR, I realized that there was a problem, which basically was that the energy loss compared to the energy stored in these electrons was too great. And I was able to show, in fact, in a fairly good way, I think, in another paper, that it couldn't work for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was kind of a possibility that was then shown to be not interesting. And then other people at about that time came in and showed that the synchrotron thing would work, and I believe that relativistic particles had been demonstrated at that point to be in the Earth's magnetosphere.
Right, right.
As I remember, there was a guy, it's one of the interesting things that Kip Thorne, who is now primarily known for his work in relativity, I think was the first person to calculate that correctly. Synchrotron radiation and dipole field. He did that, I think, as his PhD thesis at Caltech.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
And I think it's generally thought, would you agree with this, that it was Radhakrishnan's measurements of the polarization that really pinned down the synchrotron?
Yeah, sure.
But more generally about synchrotron emission, since you were quite following radio astronomy closely in the 53 to 60 period, were you aware of the Russian results on synchrotron radiation?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And did it seem to you like the way to go from the start, or did you become a believer over a long time?
No, I remember giving, shortly after I arrived at Harvard, that would have been in 55, giving a seminar, as I recall, a series of two or three talks on on the interpretation of the spectrum of Crab Nebula, and it was evident to me that this was the right way. And I think other people were being convinced too at that point. I'm not sure when the original publications of Ginsberg and
Shapiro.
Then said he was very early convinced that the synchrotron radiation was the way to go, and that's the end of the interview.